This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 82 was recorded on September 28, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Morgan Creek founder and CIO Mark Yusko will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Mark was the first guest to express a secular bearish view on the U.S. dollar on this program, and that was back in October of last year when that was a very much out-of-fashion prediction. Since then, the market has proven Mark right and me wrong. So I'm really looking forward to getting an update from Mark on his view of the U.S. dollar, as well as his take on equity market valuations, fixed income, precious metals, and much more. Now, folks, this was such a fantastic interview. It ran considerably over time, so we're going to have to break it into parts one and part two. You'll get part one today, and I promise you, before the weekend is out, we'll release a special edition with part two of my interview with Mark Yusko. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, part one with Mark Yusko, where Pete Wargent will be joining us to discuss the Australian housing bubble.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's take a look at that S&P 500 because it's been just chopping back and forth. Now, there was a little bit of selling in the NASDAQ. Some of those tech stocks were coming off. But the S&P doesn't want to give anything back. It's just coiling up here around the 2,500 level. Where's the next step for the market here?
Well, you know, Patrick, I was working on a joke for at least this week. It's not another all-time high. And then, sure enough, it's another all-time high. You know, I think the message here is this market, as you said, it just seems to want to keep pushing higher. And as I've said many times before, I do think that valuations are extremely stretched. The thing to remember, though, as Martin Armstrong said to us months ago, you know, he said, number one, this market is way overvalued. Number two, it could double from here. And the thing to remember is that the mania stage, the crazy stage where sentiment takes over and the dumb money is buying like crazy without thinking, that's where the lion's share of the upside is in bull markets. So the question I really want to focus on with Mark Yusko when we get into the feature interview is going to be not just is the valuation high, we all know that, but are there really signs that we're, you know, at the beginning of the end, or is it the end of the end? Mark's going to have a lot to say about that. I am going to let you know, though, that that will be in part two of our interview with Mark Yusko, which will be airing in a separate episode 82A, and you can look for that interview before the weekend is over. As far as the scenario that I'm thinking about lately, you know, I really think that if there's one thing the market is really good at, it's making the largest number of possible people look stupid. And there's too many people calling for October 17 as the big crash. If that was going to happen, September, you would have seen massive volatility spikes that we haven't really seen. So the scenario that I'm thinking about, and I'm definitely going to ask Mark Yusko about this one, is maybe what we see here, we get through the rest of the year. My S&P puts expire worthless. And we get through the rest of this year with all of those people being proven wrong, the bears capitulating. We get a great big Christmas rally, maybe a blow-off top as high as 2,800, 3,000 on the S&P, say, by the end of the year, some really high number. And then in the beginning of 2018, the shit hits the fan. I think that's more likely. If we get a market crash this October, next month, I think it will be the first time in history that so many people have correctly predicted the timing of a crash. So I really don't see that, but at some point, this has to end badly. And the question I'm going to focus on with Mark Yusko in part two of his interview is, when is that sometime and what should we expect?
Now, Eric, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index because it really feels like something really happened and the U.S. dollar seems to have put in some at least short-term low and has been rallying since. Is this a bottom for the U.S. dollar index? What's in store for the dollar next?
Well, I think you're right, Patrick. It does look like we have a very significant bounce in play. The question is that a dead cat bounce or the beginning of a resumption of a secular bull trend? I'm not sure. The jury is out in my mind. I was pretty darn convinced that this was a secular bull market for the dollar, and I thought that it would resume after a significant correction. This looks like that correction. By that logic, you'd think this thing's going. But, you know, we've had some really great great guests on the program, whether it be Luke Groman or my conversation today, and will be in this episode. We'll talk about the U.S. dollar in part one with Mark Yusko. My jury's still out of my mind as to whether or not there is a secular reversal in the direction of the dollar. So I'm watching this bounce carefully, looking for signs of exhaustion. So far, it's looking good. At the moment, if I just look at the chart, it seems like the bull camp is winning, but it's also too early to call this race.
Now let's move on to crude oil here. Obviously, it's surprising that crude oil has not only made it up into the 50s, but it's actually holding up here. What's your feeling here about what is next in for crude oil?
Well, this week's inventory numbers came in with a surprise drawdown in crude oil of about 1.8 million barrels. People were expecting a small build on inventory. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, did build 1.2 million barrels. Gasoline building 1.1 million barrels, where people were expecting a drawdown. Distillates drawing down 814,000 barrels. Production ticked up just very slightly by 37,000 barrels to 9.547 million barrels per day. The market reaction to inventory was extremely subdued. You know, it's not unusual to see a 50-cent price swing in the first second after that number comes out on Wednesday mornings at 10:30. We saw a nickel maybe up and then a nickel down and then a nickel up, and the market couldn't decide what it meant. So no real reaction to the inventory number. The market did, though, drift higher later in the day. And as we noted next week, there seems to be this cup and handle formation in play, which targets a $52 to $53 high. We're pretty much there. The high this morning on Thursday, early morning, was 52.86. I'm not sure exactly what caused that rip at 5 o'clock in the morning. I wasn't expecting it, but that took us up there. And then the rest of the day, we ended up trading back down substantially. So a fairly large day. It looks to me like this market is running out of steam. At some point, you know, is there one push higher? There's a target up at 53.76. Are we going to get to that one and then roll over? I'm not sure, but I think we're in the final stages of this leg higher. And once the noise is out of the system, I am still bearish. I think that there has been massive, massive hedging in this market. One quote that I found very interesting this week from an investment banker, he says he's seen more hedging by shale producers in the last 2 weeks. That's selling future production, selling futures against future oil production to hedge their prices and lock in a price now, which they need to finance their shale wells. He's seen more of that kind of selling in the last 2 weeks than the prior 6 months combined. So the smartest money, I think, knows that the top is in or close to in, and they're hedging like crazy. The rig count is going to go up, folks. And people say, well, you know, wait a minute, look at the rig count. It seems to be leveling off. Yeah, it is leveling off. The rig count has to be funded. You got to pay for those rigs with money. Where's the money come from? It comes from that hedging. The hedging is happening in the last couple of weeks. That's going to provide the funding. Expect the rig count to turn back up, and that's going to create a headwind for oil prices. Seasonality is now a headwind for oil prices. We've entered refinery maintenance season, which is when the refineries have to shut down to retool their processes. It's not really maintenance like fixing things. It's retooling their processes for winter grades of gasoline, which are a slightly different chemical formulation. The big question is, are we going to see a trend reversal of inventory draws turning into inventory builds? And as I've described in the past, it's a cloudy picture because of the hurricanes and the noise in the system. There is, however, for those of you who are conspiracy buffs in the audience, I have a formative, well, it's not quite a conspiracy theory, because I like to apply a little bit of process to this. I have a conspiracy hypothesis that I'm going to save for our post-game segment after the interview, because it's going to take a few minutes to get into it, about what might be causing the Brent WTI spread to stay as wide as it has, even in the wake of refinery capacity coming back online. So we're going to get into a whole bunch of detail on that in our post-game segment after part one of our interview with Mark Yusko.
Now let's move on to gold. Ever since we saw that U.S. dollar low, just like clockwork, gold literally within a day or two put in its short-term high, and it's been pulling back since. Where does gold go from here?
Well, Patrick, as our longtime listeners know, I've been predicting for the last several shows that we would get an opportunity to buy gold at 1281, which was a technical repair level in the market profile chart. Sure enough, this morning we hit that. Actually, 1280 spot 40 was the low print. So you had your chance, just as I predicted, to buy gold, as I said I probably would. except I didn't. And why didn't I? Well, it's all about what you said earlier, Patrick, about the dollar index bounce looking strong. So far, that dollar bounce looks really good. If the dollar rally continues, if we are going to see a resumption of a secular trend to the upside of the dollar, gold is going to take a bath. It's going to move much lower. Now, I'm not convinced of that. If it turns out that Mark Yusko is right about the dollar, we'll be getting into that in just a few minutes with Mark, then this was probably a really important opportunity to buy at a technical level that we might not see again. On the other hand, if this dollar bounce rolls over, that's a whole nother story. I decided to wait it out. Why did I wait it out? You know, I guess I'm channeling Hugh Hendry here. If there's anything that's resonated with me in recent conversations I've had with guests, it's when Hugh said on his interview a couple of weeks ago, you know, when he was a younger man, he was just so passionate about gold. He went to great lengths to make sure that his hedge fund was chartered such that it would have the mandate capability to invest in precious metals. And these days, he just doesn't find himself getting as excited as he used to about gold. I still think gold is the asset that you have to own in the end game. I just have figured out that I have been, you know, a decade early in predicting the end game for the dollar. I'm not really convinced it's upon us yet. And I'm not that excited about a non-income producing asset. If the dollar rally is over, if this is a secular reversal in the dollar, then I'm making a big mistake. This is the time to buy gold right now if you are convinced that we're in a secular dollar downtrend. I'm not convinced of that yet. I decided to pass.
Now let's move on to those treasury yields. The 10-year treasury yields are now back up to around the 230 level. What's your thinking about where interest rates are going from here?
Well, we're back up to 2.31 on the 10-year yield, well above that 2.12 level, which is our critical support level in yields. We had, as you remember, a few weeks ago, thought we were taking that out. We got all the way down to 2.05 the next week, and now we're back up here in the middle of the trading range. Mark Yusko is going to have plenty to say about the bond market. That will be, though, in Part 2, again, in Episode 82 Alpha, Part 2, which we will have released to you by the time the weekend is out.
Thanks for the market wrap, Eric. For this week's featured interview, we have Morgan Creek founder, Chief Investment Officer, Mark Yusko, to join us. Eric's interview with Mark Yusko is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Morgan Creek founder and CIO Mark Yusko. Mark sent us a fantastic 146-page slide deck to accompany today's interview. Now, obviously, we're not going to have time to touch on every single slide, but I strongly encourage you to. So please download the slide deck and peruse the whole thing. Registered users will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the red Looking for the Download button above Mark Yusko's photo on our homepage. Mark, I can't believe it has been almost a year since we had you on the show last October. And at that time, all the smart guys that we had on the program were super, uber bullish the U.S. dollar on a secular level. Then you came along and you proclaimed that the dollar was topping. You held a bearish view, not just as a trade, but you articulated a secular bearish view about the dollar gradually weakening over a long time horizon as its hegemony in the global financial system comes into serious question. Now, as of the time of our last interview, holding a bearish view on the dollar was extremely unfashionable in macro circles. A year later, we're about 10% lower on the DXY. So if there's anything I've learned in this business, Mark, it's that you don't want to pay attention to the guy with the most eloquent explanation of what already happened. You want to pay attention to the guy who got it right when it was unpopular to be right. And that clearly is you in this case. So for the benefit of our newer listeners who may not remember that interview, let's start from the beginning. Please explain your view. How did you know a year ago that the dollar was topping, and what you see is not only just a pullback or something, but a secular change in direction? What is this all about, and what can we expect from here for the U.S. dollar?
Eric, it's great to be back, and it is hard to believe it's been a year, and I appreciate the kind words. One of the keys to investing generally, right, is if you're thinking what everyone else is thinking, there's usually not a lot of thinking going on. So if you want to make the big returns, you've got to come up with variant perceptions. So that's something that's different than the consensus. And you've got to play that out, and then you got to be right. So, you know, Michael Steinhardt had a great quote about that. He says, all of our big money came from variant perceptions that turned out to be right. So it doesn't do you any good if you're a variant perception and you're wrong. So, you know, when we go back a year, and actually I'll go all the way back a year and a little over a year and a half, is this all started to come together for me in January of 2016. And what had happened is the Fed had just raised rates, and everybody then was uber bullish because, look, the dollar had run hard in 2015 into the beginning of 2016, and the Fed had raised rates in that December, and everybody was convinced that the dollar was going up. Now, if you actually look at history, that's not what happens. The dollar tends to anticipate the moves of the Fed, so it tends to rally in advance of hiking cycles. And it usually starts down after the second raise in rates. Now, she took her own sweet time to raise rates. She went in a whole nother year. So in January 2016, I came out with my usual 10 surprises. I, you know, borrowed or stole Byron Wien's 10 surprises thing. And my first one there was that King Dollar had been dethroned. And that came from the fact that we were in for a cyclical peak in what I believe is a secular decline. I think a secular decline in the dollar started in the 80s. I think the dollar's been in decline since then, and it's a combination of demographics is destiny. So we just have, we have an aging population, and we have too much debt, and then we have this persistent deflation that's being caused by technological advances. And so when you put all that together, I said King Dollar's dethroned, and we're going to start moving toward a more of a multipolar world and the ascendancy of the renminbi. And I took immeasurable grief in 16 about that. And it started to play out, and the dollar actually did start to fall in the summer of 16. But then, you know, Draghi did his usual, you know, whatever it takes thing in the July meeting, and Kuroda-san said that he was going to weaken the yen even more, and suddenly the dollar was back in vogue, and it kind of recovered most of those losses. So it was flat for most of the year. And then we have the election. The election comes, and basically everybody jumps on this reflation trade, that, that Trump somehow magically was going to create GDP growth out of thin air, that that was going to allow interest rates to rise dramatically. They're going to have four rate hikes anytime now. And so it came to January of this year in 17, and the cover of The Economist magazine, December, whatever it was, 5th or 6th, was, you know, the big buff, you know, George Washington basically saying the dollar was ruling the world. And I'm like, okay, that's the peak. And that literally was the peak, DXY at 103. We've been downhill ever since. And I jumped on in January this year saying, okay, now I'm putting the pedal to the floor on this bear dollar bet, and we're going down from here. And that was King Dollar's last stand. And what I loved about it is I got absolutely blistered on Twitter and everywhere. Really smart people who I have a lot of admiration for, people like Raoul Paul and others, who he's a friend, right? I mean, he was just saying, Mark, you're out of your mind, and there's just no way this is happening. And, you know, my view, to answer your question, you say, Mark, when are you going to answer my question, is, look, the world is just going to have less dollars in it. You know, we cut a deal in 1971 with the Saudis, and we said, we'll protect you. In exchange, we're going to close the gold window, create a real true fiat currency, but we need something to back it. So we need oil to always be priced in dollars. And as long as you agree to do that, we'll buy your oil and we'll protect you and everything will be great in the Middle East. And we've been doing that faithfully. And anytime someone threatened to price oil in anything other than dollars, we actually invaded. Iraq tried to price in euros, invaded them. Libya tried to price in gold, invaded them. So we've had this dollar petrodollar world, and with oil prices at $26 instead of $147, there's going to be less petrodollars. With oil prices even at $50, there's less than there were at $147. But the real thing that people missed, and this actually came from a trip to Hong Kong in January, right before I wrote my surprises, everyone, including a lot of your guests in the past and others, were absolutely convinced the renminbi was going to collapse. It was going to have to devalue. And the dollar, therefore, was going to be ascendant. And the renminbi was toast. And everybody's trying to get short. And they were buying options on these things. And when I was in Hong Kong in January, I went to this Merrill Lynch roundtable, CIO roundtable, and there were 40 of the best investors and largest investors all over Asia. And pretty universally in that group, people are like, no chance does the renminbi weaken this year. In fact, it should actually strengthen, which was just total heresy in January. And so I kind of had a tangent to my thesis, which was not only is the dollar going to fall, but the renminbi is actually going to rise. And that got as much criticism too. So that's a long, very long twisted way of saying that the dollar is on its way out as the world reserve currency. The renminbi has become a world reserve currency. It's included in the SDR now as of August last year. And MSCI has now said they're going to include Chinese equities in their indices, which is a huge thing, which means there's going to be more demand for renminbi denominated assets. So we're in this transition, just like we are in a transition from 1913 when the pound sterling was the world reserve currency and they invaded Mesopotamia, incurred a bunch of debt, the pound sterling collapsed, the dollar ascended. But it took 31 years until 1944, Bretton Woods, where we actually became the world reserve currency. So I don't think this is going to take 31 years for the renminbi to ascend, but I think it's coming.
Now, as much as that was a long answer, I have at least three follow-up questions because this is such an important topic. First of all, you talk about ascendance of the renminbi as a world reserve currency. Reserve currency really has two definitions. One is the trade settlement currency. That's pretty easy, and we see a lot of signs of that. But the other thing is U.S. Treasury bonds are the preferred reserve asset of central banks. And something I've struggled with for a long time is, wait a minute, you know, you can't replace U.S. Treasuries as the reserve asset of central banks until there is another bond market in the world that's deep and liquid enough to absorb central bank-sized capital flows. So do you see that that is going to be ascended as well, that there will be a Chinese renminbi treasury market, which is offshore yuan and which is big enough to become the new reserve asset? Or do central banks go back to gold? Or how do you see that aspect of it being addressed if it's not the U.S. dollar and U.S. treasuries?
No, 100% agree that that's going to happen. It's just going to take a while. And the thing that people miss, I mean, I was just in Shanghai last week. We have an office there. We've had an office there for a decade. I've been investing there for 20 years. And I don't even recognize Shanghai when I go back there. It's just Pudong used to be a rice paddy, literally. And now they've got three of the tallest buildings in the world sitting right next to each other. And they make the Empire State Building look like a little toy soldier. But what people miss is that China plays Go while the rest of us around the world argue about how to set up the checkerboard. They're just playing a different game, and they plan in 10-year increments. They don't do anything for 6 months or a year. They do everything for a decade. They're about to have this 19th Party Congress to come up with the next five-year plan, but it's really a 10 and 20 and 30-year plan. And they said very clearly 5 years ago that their goal was that the renminbi become stable. They didn't really care what the value was relative to any single currency like the dollar. What they cared was relative to a basket of global currencies. They wanted it to be stable. And Eric, just as you said so brilliantly, what they want is for it to become an asset relied on by other central banks around the world as a portion of their assets. And so people say, well, that's not possible. They don't have a deep treasury market. Well, of course they don't, but they will. And it may take a decade, but they don't care because they're looking at, you know, multiple decade time horizons. And whether it's 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, it's really not that important for a secular move. For cyclical moves, it certainly is. But for a secular move, you know, decades are a short duration. So I do think they're going to get there. I do think that stability is job one. And they have made inroads into central banks. There are people starting to dip their toe into these SDRs. And is it a long-term goal? Absolutely. Is it going to happen overnight? Definitely not. But I think it's going to happen. And I'm not wed to the idea that it becomes the world reserve currency anytime soon, because the capital T-H-E is very different than A, capital A. And the has historically been reserved for country with the best navy. And if you go all the way back, right, that was Portugal. Imagine that Portugal had the world reserve currency in the 1600s. People are like, that's impossible. Well, it actually was true. Why? Because they had the tallest trees, which meant they had the fastest ships. And then ultimately, the UK took over the land all over the world. They, you know, had their colonies all over the world, and they grew taller trees, and then they had faster ships. And then the steam engine came along, and America ascended to have the best navy. And today, we have naval superiority. Therefore, we have the world reserve currency. I do have a thesis on this, though. And people say, well, there's no way China will ever have a better navy. Have you seen any of these pictures of the South China Sea lately? They got a pretty good navy, actually. But I actually don't think it's about that. I think ground wars and human wars, hopefully, touch wood, are a thing of the past. Because I was also in South Korea last week, and we can talk about that. But I think that's a thing of the past. I think the new warfare is cyber. And in cyber warfare and technology warfare, I think China is a pretty formidable competitor or combatant. So could hegemony change to meaning that it's the person who's most in charge of AI, machine learning, and all the things that are going to evolve out of that, edge computing and quantum computing and all these things? Again, long answer to a simple question. Yes, I think they're on their way to creating a deep and liquid bond market. And yes, global central banks around the world will own renminbi-denominated bonds. They probably won't be called, well, definitely won't be called treasuries. I don't know what they'll be called. In fact, you know, I have a hashtag on Twitter for a lot of this stuff, you want a piece of me. And actually, Kyle Bass and I are going to debate this on Friday the 13th down in Dallas at an Alts Texas event. So that should be fun, too.
Wow. Well, to be sure, China is building out its deep water navy. And, you know, it blows my mind. People will tell you, oh, China only has one aircraft carrier they bought secondhand, the USS-10. Yeah, but that's not the aircraft carrier battle group is kind of a dated technology. If you look at submarine launched nuclear missile capability, China is right there with the United States. So
exactly.
It is a scary thought. I want to go back, though, and follow up specifically now on the petrodollar aspect of this that you alluded to a few minutes ago. A new development since our last interview is the pending introduction of a crude oil futures contract that will trade on the Shanghai Futures Exchange, will be denominated in Chinese yuan, and will also be convertible to gold for the benefit of oil exporting nations who might prefer gold over yuan as a final settlement currency. Now, the mainstream media has dismissed this as completely irrelevant because, after all, who other than China wants to buy oil with yuan? But when I interviewed Luke Roman recently, he actually thinks this has the potential to be a game changer. Specifically, he thinks this contract was intentionally engineered to be a petrodollar killer, to give the rest of the world a mechanism to stop transacting in dollars for oil. What's your take, Mark? Is this new de-dollarized crude oil contract something that's important? Could it be a game changer? And how does it affect your outlook for the dollar generally?
Yes, important, incredibly important. Absolutely a game changer, absolutely designed specifically to kill petrodollars, and no question in my mind, it bolsters the thesis of the decline of the dollar. So King Dollar has clearly been dethroned. Whether the renminbi ascends into that throne right away, we'll reserve judgment on that, and whether it stays open for a while, like gets abdicated and just stays open. I love the Western media. We all suffer from this thing called home market myopia, right? We all think that all the smart people live where we live. So if you look at people's portfolios around the world, people in the U.S. have more U.S. equities, and people in Korea have more Korean equities, and people in China have more Chinese equities, and people in the U.K. have more U.K. equities. And we think all the smart people live where we live. And that's just clearly not true. And the leadership group of China and I'm not ashamed to say this, is way more intelligent, way better at leading and managing than our administration in the United States. It's not even close. You know, I'd like to say it's like major leagues and double A or single A, but I'm not even sure it's not a good college team in the U.S. But the leadership group, particularly the financial leadership group in China, has always, not always, has been for the last decade and a half, two decades, been leagues ahead of our treasury group in the United States. We're so focused on the U.S. and making sure that all of our banks get preferential treatment and that they can make excess profits. And, you know, it's all for one for all on too big to fail. China's, you know, been figuring out ways, again, to displace the dollar as this global reserve currency. Clearly, the way to do that is to get at this link between us and the Saudis and the pricing of oil and dollars around the world. And this is not just a shot across the bow. This is, look, to make this even bigger, we can talk about this topic too, is OBOR, the One Belt, One Road, which is maybe the biggest thing that we're going to be talking about for the next two or three decades, which is the reconstruction of the Silk Trade routes, is a clear and purposeful attempt, not even attempt, a plan to move the center of the economic universe back to its rightful place in Eurasia. And it's got clear partnership with Russia, India, North Africa, parts of Europe, Holland, of all things, is on board with this. And it's all about the fact that for 1800 of the last 2000 years, China and India ruled the world. And you know, only in the last 200 was this failed experiment with communism. And now they figured it out. They've gone back to capitalism in the 80s. And they are on track to ascend back to the global dominant powerhouse. And the center of the universe is going to move back to Eurasia. And Russia clearly would love to X out the dollar in oil transactions. I mean, they would love to sell all kinds of stuff directly to the Chinese back and forth. So this is not only not a small thing, it's a monster thing.
Now, since you're the guy who's been right about the dollar, and frankly, I'm the guy who's been wrong about the dollar for the last 6 months, I'd like to ask you to help me sort out my views on this, because for more than 10 years now, I've had a view which is very consistent with yours. I've felt that the U.S. dollar has to, not just might, but has to lose its reserve currency status. Definitely in our lifetimes. I don't know when, but sometime.
Right.
And that has to lead to a fiscal crisis in the United States, possibly a U.S. Treasury bond crisis. Now, when I first developed those views a decade ago, I became extremely bearish on the U.S. dollar. I'm shorting the dollar. I was tempted to short treasuries. Thank heaven I didn't. What I eventually realized, though, is that as bad as the U.S. financial situation is, it's worse in Europe and it's worse in Japan. And that led me to a new view where I said, okay, wait a minute. The dollar is going to have an end game, but the way this plays out, the way it's trying to fool me, is what's really going to happen is there's going to be this flight capital into, because everybody in the world thinks the U.S. dollar is the strongest currency on earth. The fact that you see that as changing, you're way ahead of the pack. So I came back to this view that, okay, what's really going to happen is it's like there's one final blow off top. There's going to be real problems in Japan. There's going to be real problems in Europe as the whole socialist system breaks down there. They can't make good on all the promises that they had made with other people's money. It all falls apart. There's flight capital out of Europe and Japan into the U.S. dollar. That's the blow off top. And then eventually the end game starts. So I was thinking U.S. dollar, it keeps getting better for the U.S. dollar, ironically, because it's the way we get to the eventual endgame. That was sort of going my way for the last few years. So what is it that we hit the blow-off top already, or did I just not see the picture right? It sounds like you think, you know, that phenomenon of flight capital coming from the rest of the world into the U.S. dollar is not going to save the dollar, as I was thinking, at least in the short term. So where did I go wrong in my thinking?
No, I actually don't think any of your thinking is wrong at all. I actually think it's very cogent, very logical, and very well thought out and makes perfect sense. And we have seen it, right? I mean, every wealthy person in the world, and okay, that's too strong. I speak in hyperbole, but you know, that's what I do. So probably not every wealthy person in the world, but the majority of wealthy people in the world find a way to get a portion of their wealth into the U.S. dollar. But then if you think about it, that's no different than all the wealthy people in the United States who find a way to get their a portion of their wealth into some other currency, whether it be euro or yen or gold or whatever it is. So you know, there's plenty of gold buried in Swiss vaults in Switzerland that used to be dollars. So this movement of capital into the perceived safe haven asset, I think is real. But what I actually think is kind of curious is how can the Japanese yen still be a safe haven trade, right? When the equity markets are tanking, what happens to the yen? It doesn't go down, it actually goes up. And so there are still people all over the world that are putting capital in yen when they get afraid. So it's not just dollars. So I think where maybe the argument breaks down just a little bit, because I think the argument is sound, is that quietly and almost like the old story about, you know, you can't put a frog in hot water because he jumps out. You got to turn up the heat slowly. Is I think the way currency markets have been functioning of late is incrementalism. And then people suddenly are shocked at what's happened. And, you know, I think there's so many examples of this from, you know, when there's a crisis in a currency like, you know, the South African rand or like the Asian crisis back in 98 or whether it was the ruble crisis when oil collapsed. But what happened incrementally up to that point, I think, is always very interesting. And so let's look at the big currencies around the world. You know, there's the big three. There's the euro, the yen, and the dollar. I will argue, and it's a little bit different than your argument, but not really that different. I'll argue that those big three are locked in a race to the bottom based on a combination of bad demographics. You have rapidly aging populations. And the great thing about this is we can see how this is going to play out by looking at Japan, because Europe's 9 years behind Japan and we're 10 and a half years behind Japan. And so everything that happens in Japan happens 9 years later in Europe and 10 and a half years later in the US, whether it's a downgrade of debt, whether it's a collapse in the currency, whether it's reneging on promises. 11 years ago, the Bank of Japan said they were going to cut their balance sheet. At the time, their balance sheet was 23% of GDP, and they said they were going to cut it. And they actually did cut it a couple percent for about 2 years. Today, the Bank of Japan's balance sheet as a percent of GDP is 93%, 9-3. So yeah, the ECB said, oh, we can't possibly do QE and, you know, we can't possibly increase our balance sheet. Suddenly it's 39% of GDP on its way to 90% of GDP, just like Japan. And look at the US. Here we are, 26, 25% saying we're going to cut the balance sheet. What a joke. There's no chance we're going to cut the balance sheet. Maybe we cut it by half a percent or something over the next couple of years. But then we're going to start buying more bonds and we're going to start buying equities just like the Japanese did. Japanese didn't start buying equities until 10 years ago. I'm sorry, not even 10 years ago. It was 7 years ago. So we've still got 3 years before we probably start buying equities in the US. So all these things happen in slow motion. And I think the subtle difference between my view and your view and Raoul's view and other smart people's view is I think that the drip, drip, drip of people using riyal and people using renminbi and people using rupee is out distancing the demand for dollars, because what does the US make today? We make cars, we make some airplanes, we make oil, and we make petroleum, refined petroleum product, gasoline. That's kind of it. And there are a whole bunch of countries around the world that make lots of stuff, and now they're trading more with each other than they are with us. And one of the things that I found really interesting, and another reason I am confident that the dollar is secularly in this decline, is, you know, when Trump got elected, it was all about, oh, I'm going to start a trade war with China. No, you're not. Because you do realize that since they were admitted to WTO, our exports to China have grown five times as fast as our imports from China. And I tell this little story about, you know, this friend of mine, maybe 6-7 years ago, daughter came up to him at Christmas time and said, Daddy, I thought you said Santa Claus makes the presents. He says, well, honey, Santa Claus does make the presents. Why? He says, well, they all say made in China. And it used to be about made in China. Today, again, having been there last week, it's all about made for China. People in China now have wealth. They've taken 50% of their population. Just let that number sink in for a second. They've taken 50% of their population out of abject poverty since 1983 when they converted to capitalism. That's an astonishing number. They urbanize 20 million people every year. That means they construct five cities the size of Philadelphia every single year. The scale at which some of these places operate is just not something that we sitting over here with our home, you know, market myopian view and our Western media that can never get it right, because half of the people that comment in Western media have never even been to China, which is just comical to me. They have all these views on China and they've actually never even been to see it. So anyway, again, long rambling answer to what was a pretty simple question.
Mark, I want to cut you off right there because this is really fantastic content. And I had to chuckle as I was listening. We're about 25 minutes in, more than half of our usual time budget. And that was my first topic, U.S. dollar, out of about 9 topics. If there's anything that we've heard consistently from our listeners, it's don't cut the guest off in the interest of time. We want to hear everything they've got to say. Now, we can't possibly do that in this episode because we do have some constraints. So what I'm going to do is make a promise. Folks, bear with us. We're going to somehow, before the weekend is out, either Friday or Saturday or something, we're going to get part two with Mark Yusko. And there's probably another 45 minutes to an hour of fantastic content coming up with Mark Yusko. So be sure to tune back in for that. Meanwhile, Patrick Ceresna and I will be welcoming Pete Wargent to our postgame segment as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Mark Yusko. Now, listeners, we're going to get part two of that interview out to you as soon as we can. Before we bring Pete Wargent to discuss the Australian real estate bubble, you mentioned something in our market wrap about a theory you're working on to explain why Brent WTI spread has continued to widen to more than $6. What's on your mind?
Well, Patrick, the thing that's really caught my attention is the explosion of U.S. exports of crude oil in the last few weeks. To put this in perspective, week ending September 1st, United States exported 153,000 barrels per day of crude oil, 153,000. Week ending 9/22, 1.491 million barrels per day. Now, multiply that by 7 days in a week, that's more than 10 million barrels per week of U.S. crude oil that's being exported. Now, remember, it was illegal to export U.S. crude oil until very recently. So we're now exporting 10 million barrels a day, and those 10 million barrels, by their very definition, had to have come out of what otherwise would have been counted as U.S. inventory. So that means that the size of the drawdown or the size of the build, you know, it's moving from the build category into the drawdown category to the tune of 10 million barrels. That led me to my conspiracy hypothesis, which is I thought, wait a minute. You know, the Brent WTI spread, that's the premium for Brent European crude oil over WTI, West Texas Intermediate U.S. crude oil, has blown out dramatically after the hurricanes. And it makes perfect sense. You know, Hurricane Harvey took a bunch of refining capacity offline. That suppresses demand for U.S. crude oil. That means that Brent is going to trade at a premium over WTI. It makes perfect sense. No question there. But hang on. What happens after the refineries start coming back online? the Brent WTI spread continues to widen beyond $6.50 premium Brent over WTI. And I'm thinking, what the heck is going on that would cause that spread to continue to widen even after the U.S. demand that was the logical explanation for it widening in the first place has reversed direction? What's going on? And I thought, wait a minute. With exports now legal, the fact that that spread is widening leads to what could be a profitable arbitrage. In other words, traders are able to buy oil on the Gulf Coast in Houston or in Louisiana, put it on a tanker ship, send it over to Europe, sell it into the Brent contract, and basically lock in a risk-free arbitrage. Now, I am not expert on tanker logistics and all that, but my first thought off the top of my head was, well, if there's a $6.50 premium, that's got to be enough to charter a ship and deliver it, because, you know, just a decade ago, the cost of oil was $10 in the United States. Part of that was getting it here from the Middle East, so, you know, $6.50 seemed like enough. I got thinking about that and thought, wow, you know, could it be that Saudi Arabia saw what happened after the hurricane, noticed that spread blowing out, and said, hey, if we can keep this spread wide, it's going to create an incentive for arbitrageurs to move crude oil out of the U.S. inventory, creating the illusion of rebalancing of supply and demand. And that would definitely work to increase dramatically U.S. crude oil prices. So I got to thinking in my little conspiracy hypothesis that could it be that, you know, and it's a shell game to be sure. If you're moving that oil from U.S. storage into storage somewhere else in the world, you haven't done anything to change the supply glut. You're not changing the supply demand actual dynamics. But what you are doing is you're taking that oil out of view. It's no longer visible in the U.S. EIA reports that come out every Wednesday morning. And I thought, could it be that Saudi Arabia is buying that spread? Now, remember, Saudi Aramco just announced like a week ago that they're going to start trading, how convenient is that, in non-Saudi produced oil products. Well, if you're the largest exporter of oil and you spend a few $100 million to just pump that spread out with a trade that loses money, obviously for a normal trader, that doesn't make sense. But if you're trying to do it to create an incentive for other people to move all the oil out of storage in the United States to other places, so U.S. storage comes down, U.S. oil prices go up, the rest of the world ends up following suit, and you've now manipulated the oil price dramatically higher into your IPO planned for Saudi Aramco in 2018. Wouldn't that be a neat trick? Now, for you conspiracy fans, you should probably stop listening here because I actually do research these things. So, you know, if you're willing to make a fool of yourself on Twitter, I put this theory out and in front of a lot of very, very knowledgeable people, many more knowledgeable than myself. Bryn Kelly, an analyst I know well, super, super lady. You really want to follow her if you are at all interested in energy. Bryn K. Kelly, B-R-Y-N-N-E Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y. And I think the middle initial K is in the handle. Put in B-R-Y-N-N-E in Twitter and you'll see it in the search box there. She pointed out to me that the spread from WTI to Brent is not what's relevant. It's the spread from what you can buy the oil in Houston or Louisiana Gulf Coast to Brent, and it's not wide enough for a profitable arbitrage. So that kind of blows that theory. And they also thought that maybe the exports that we're seeing could be a natural backlog from the hurricane, exports waiting to get out. So the notion that, you know, there's an evil conspiracy for Saudi Arabia to be manipulating the Brent WTI spread in order to create this arbitrage to move oil out of the country, probably that's not actually reality. Drat. Can't have the conspiracy you were hoping for. But still, I say, it really says something to me that there is still a lot of possibility here. We know that Saudi Arabia has a huge incentive to manipulate prices higher into their IPO, doing whatever they can to do it. Now, it may not have created a risk-free arbitrage if they were playing that Brent WTI spread, but certainly as that spread expands, it creates an incentive for other exporters to favor selling into the Brent market as opposed to selling into the U.S. market. So, you know, I do think it's possible that there are games being played, whether it be the Brent WTI spread exactly specifically, I don't know. But I think that this announcement that Saudi Aramco is suddenly going to start trading oil products other than their own production is suspicious to me. I wonder if they're gaming the system in order to manipulate prices higher in advance of the IPO that's planned for Saudi Aramco. This particular theory on how they might be doing it doesn't appear to completely hold out, but I do think there is a very important point. Probably the most important comment that I heard on Twitter was one person saying, look, that conspiracy hypothesis might not be true, but what is true is the utility of the U.S. inventory system in analyzing supply and demand is greatly diminished now in this era of legalized export of U.S. crude. It doesn't tell us as much as it used to know what the inventory level is this week versus last week in an environment where it's legal to export it and you could have storage just moving to cheaper storage that's offshore that doesn't get counted. The oil didn't get used. It's still in storage, but it's in storage someplace else because the transportation logistics could be arbitraged in some way. So again, I do encourage you, for people who really want to learn more about the details of the physical oil market, I don't know anybody smarter than Bryn K. Kelly on Twitter. She's a good friend and a great source of information. She set me straight on my conspiracy hypothesis. Didn't make it to conspiracy theory, but I'll keep working on one for next time. I would, in the meantime, however, welcome any listeners to explain to me, because this is still a huge mystery in my mind, even if it's not Saudi Arabia doing it, how in the heck do you explain the Brent WTI spread continuing to widen dramatically even after U.S. refining capacity came back online? And you could say, well, it's Kurdistan. Well, that's only come up in the last couple of days. Before that happened, you had U.S. refining capacity coming back online, Brent WTI spread continuing to widen. And I cannot figure out why the heck that would be happening unless somebody somewhere is trying to manipulate it in order to influence inventory levels. I welcome any contrary views. By all means, post it on Twitter or send it to us, info@macrovoices.
Wow, that's a real food for thought, to say the least here, Eric. Now, going on to this week's post game, we have Pete Wargent, the CEO of Wargent Advisory, which is a macroeconomic advisory firm in Australia providing subscription analysis and reports to sophisticated investors. Welcome aboard, Pete.
Pleasure.
All right. Now, Pete, you were referred to us by our friend Jonathan Tepper at Variant Perception, who recommended you as an expert on the Australian housing bubble. Now, we think of Jonathan as an expert on the subject, so if you got his endorsement, we're certainly keen to hear your views on the subject. Now, why don't we start with the bigger picture? Is the Australian housing market in a bubble? And if so, can you give us an overview of the Australian housing market and the Australian economy now in that post-mining boom?
Sure. So, I mean, there are two key indicators that are pointing towards bubble conditions. There's, with record low interest rates, we've now got household debt to disposable income. Australia's right up there at the very top of the tree, or second or third place globally. So 190% plus now of household debt to disposable income. So the other thing that's been kicked off by rising price is a record construction boom, particularly of high-rise apartments in Australia. So we've got more dwellings under construction than we've ever seen before, and by a huge margin. So those two indicators are pointing towards a high-risk market at the moment. In terms of the economy, I guess rewinding the clock, from the early 2000s, Australia kicked off its resources boom on the back of demand from China, unprecedented boom in bulk commodity prices. So in Australia, of course, iron ore and coal, and that in turn led to the construction of iron ore, coal and LNG projects on a huge scale, you know, a couple of $100 billion invested in LNG projects alone. And that period was known in Australia simply as the mining boom. Engineering construction activity was massive. We were tracking at about $35 billion a quarter in 2012, and more than double what we were doing even in 2007. But then since 2012, Australia went off a capex cliff, or a mining cliff, as they call it. And construction activity really fell sharply in that sector. That's forced the Reserve Bank to cut interest rates to record low levels. So the cash rate now just 1.5%. And the economy to date, at least, has plugged that gap quite successfully with residential construction and more recently some infrastructure such as roads and rail. But the knock-on effect of low rates has been spectacular. Blow off in Sydney and Melbourne house prices. Those are the two main capital cities in Australia, and about 40% of the population. So therefore, we've seen a massive surge in interest in our market analysis from overseas, hedge funds wanting subscription reports and taking a good deal of interest in Australia on the short side. There's plenty of developers who've gone bust in the past 6 months, but for overseas investors, particularly larger investors, it's also about understanding liquidity and how to find opportunities in that market.
Pete, I don't know how Australians think about housing prices, but I would say cynically that Americans don't think at all about housing prices. They only think about the monthly payment. So I guess my question is, it sounds like really low mortgage rates are what has driven this. So have the mortgage rates gone as low as they can? Would you agree that mortgage rates are the key here? And when does this blow up? When do the mortgage rates eventually get to the point where the situation is no longer tenable?
Yeah, it's a really good question because we don't have mortgage rates in Australia that are as low as, say, you would see in the United Kingdom, for example, where people are borrowing at under 2%. In Australia, we see mortgage rates ranging anywhere from 3.6% for owner-occupiers, but for investors, rates have been ratcheted higher by the regulator, essentially. So a lot of investors would be borrowing at 5.5%. But there's been a change in personnel at the Reserve Bank, and there's obviously a lot less appetite than there was to see rates go any lower than they already have. So the general feeling is that the bottom of the cycle is in the cash rate, and mortgage rates have already been moving a bit higher. Some of that was instigated by APRA, the regulator. With interest-only loans at one stage were 45% of the entire mortgage market, which was just insane and unsustainable. Particularly for those interest-only loans, we've seen rates being pushed higher by the banks, with the regulator breathing down their neck. So I guess what a lot of analysts are interested to know is, well, when those interest-only loans reach the end of their interest-only period, which is typically 5 years in Australia, when those loans flip into principal and interest, potentially in a higher mortgage rate environment, well, what happens then? Because those loans could be seeing repayments 40% higher than when the loans were taken out.
So the big risk is when you get, what we had in the U.S. was when we had the adjustment on the adjustable rate mortgages. Your risk comes at the end of the interest-only period when you get to interest and principal period. What concerns me, though, you mentioned also that there is a boom in high-rise construction. So is that going to lead to a glut of apartments? And how is the completion of that construction going to coincide from a timing standpoint with this change in mortgage repayments going from interest-only back to interest in principal? Sounds like kind of a perfect storm setup.
Yes, and that's the term that the media has been using. So at the last count, there are more than 215,000 dwellings under construction. More than 150,000 of those are being attached dwellings of one type or another. I think you need to see those figures charted to understand just how that stacks up against historical norms. But I mean, historically, you'd be more likely to see 20 to 40,000 attached dwellings under construction. So it's huge. And there are already some glut in some of the inner city hotspots, Melbourne's Docklands, certain parts of Sydney, and a very significant glut of overbuilding in inner city Brisbane. So valuations are now frequently coming in low when apartments are due to settle. So that's increasing default risk. But it's also believed that many of the new apartments have been bought offshore by Chinese investors with small down payments. So that also adds to default risk. Now, local lenders become quite fearful of a royal commission, so they've essentially stopped lending or stopped funding offshore buyers. So officially, non-settlements remain quite low, as reported by the listed developers, but some settlements have been pushed out. Yeah, the combination of those factors, interest-only loans coming to the end of their interest-only period, and I think historically, Aussies felt that they could always roll over an interest-only loan into a new similar product, but APRA, the regulator, is clearly trying to clamp down on that now. So there's a few factors pointing towards the next year, 18 months, as being a very tricky one for the Australian housing market.
Now, Pete, I have to ask you, like, I'm a Canadian, I'm based in Toronto, so I'm in one of the epicenters for real estate that has a lot of similarities to the Australian housing market. And yet, there's some interesting things going on here in Canada. We're seeing the government starting to heavily clamp down on lending standards. Not only is Stephen Poloz raising interest rates, which is impacting mortgage rates, but we're seeing them now implementing stress testing on applicants as much as 200 basis points of stress testing before you can get applied for a mortgage. How is the household debt and the lending standards in Australia?
Yeah, so the serviceability quite similar in Australia. So you'll be stress tested if you borrowed today at typically 7.25%. So that would be at least a couple of hundred basis points higher than you'd be expecting to pay initially. I suppose loan to value ratios, we're seeing much less high LVR lending, but in Australia it's become quite common for the deposit to be paid out of existing equity, so hence all the headlines about Ponzi schemes and so on, because many first home buyers have been priced out of the market while the existing owners with equity have been redrawing equity to buy more property. So on the one hand, serviceability criteria have been tightened up, but that hasn't necessarily stopped existing investors and existing homeowners from redrawing equity. And you can see what it's been doing to house prices, particularly in Sydney. Sydney's median house price is more than doubled since 2009 from an already expensive level to about 1.15 million Aussie dollars. And apartment prices in Sydney have followed a pretty similar trend. In our reports for hedge funds, we do a lot of bottom-up analysis because I think the median price data, you lose some of that detail. We look at like-for-like resales. And in some of the poorest suburbs of Sydney, which is typically Western Sydney, so 30 miles or so from the city. We've seen prices compounding at 15, 20% for several years, and that's in some of the lowest socio-demographic suburbs. So areas where median household incomes might be, say, 50,000 Aussie dollars, and yet we're seeing house prices transacting for 700,000, 800,000, sometimes even more. And there's a lot of very poor quality housing, what's known as fibros in Australia, in those deprived areas, essentially asbestos shacks. So a key risk here is that there's so many housing market investors, and investors comprise more than 50% of the entire Sydney mortgage market at the peak, bought in those areas with the expectation of rising prices, but using interest-only products. So there's a lot of risks around.
All right. Well, I want to now move on to talking about the impact of Chinese investors, because I guess you can almost define the 2015-2016 years as this massive tidal wave of money flowing internationally out of China, and it basically flowed into real estate all over the world. Obviously, Sydney down there in Australia, or Vancouver out in Canada, were some of the epicenters for a lot of these international investors buying up properties. And I know they did that in Australia, but in Vancouver and in Toronto, they suddenly now have implemented these 15% foreign ownership taxes to kind of deter all foreign investors from buying the real estate. What's the situation with that in Australia right now?
Yeah, a lot of similarities. So it's important to note that the non-residents in Australia can normally only buy new dwellings unless they're developing and adding to the housing stock. So the idea is that this encourages new construction, and therefore a huge chunk of the new apartment stock is sold offshore. And pretty much out of nowhere, from 2012, we had this whole new market of mainland Chinese investors. And that's been one of the key drivers, along with record low interest rates, of the high-rise construction boom. And some developers, they got lazy. They're building an awful lot of high-rise apartment stock for investors, but much more than the local rental market genuinely demands. So that's one part of the Chinese phenomenon. The other part is the illegal buying by non-residents of established property. Now, this stuff is hard to trace, and the tax office has investigated it. But the thing is, in Australia, you have 1 million people plus of Chinese heritage anyway, so money could be passed to friends and family. We also have just skyrocketing numbers of visitors from China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, 1.75 million over the last 12 months. So the pathways for Chinese money coming into Australia have been multiplying. That said, I think the trend has slowed. I mentioned the lenders and bankers in Australia are a bit fearful of a royal commission that has been proposed by the opposition Labor Party. So local lenders have all but stopped funding offshore purchases. But they've also introduced now in some states, including the most populous two states, new stamp duty surcharges for non-resident buyers. So that too has had a slowing impact.
Pete, in the United States housing bust, of course, almost all of the mortgages in the U.S. are securitized. So the short trade was very obvious. It was basically credit default swaps on the bonds that are behind those mortgages. Now, as I understand it, most mortgages in Australia are not securitized. So what is the investment play here? And particularly for people who may be offshore, you know, I've got an Interactive Brokers account. I can trade the Australian stock market, but maybe don't have a lot of familiarity with its rules. Is it shorting banks? Is it another trade? What's the play here?
Yeah, I mean that is literally the million-dollar question. I think, as you said, there's no directly correlated short to Australian housing. So the banks have been a popular choice, and there has been some traction on some of the big four banks shorts in recent times. Another popular trade has just simply been the Aussie dollar, which has already come down now from well over parity against the US dollar, recently trading around 80 cents. I think a lot of analysts have done modelling, but I think it would be fair to say that should the residential construction downturn really take hold as we're expecting, there's a good chance that the Aussie dollar could be some way lower than it is today. Timing, obviously, the hard part. But there are a number of proxies sectors that people look at. Developers are an obvious one. There are a couple of mortgage insurers in Australia. And then for some of the smaller players in the market, the real estate agents, retail, household goods, some of the non-bank lenders, real estate trusts, materials companies. So there's no direct trade, but there are some that are more obvious than others.
For our institutional listeners who might be interested in the advisory services that you offer to hedge funds, where can they find out more about your work?
So the best place to get in contact is our website. So that's wargentadvisory.com. We offer consulting services, subscription analysis, and reports on the Aussie economy and housing markets.
Well, Pete, thanks so much for joining us on today's postgame segment. We really appreciate your time. Listeners, as you know, we need your help. The way that we're able to get really great guests like Mark Yusko on today's program is the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best names. So please, if you haven't done so already, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a few minutes. The benefit to you is that you get our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best stuff that we could find on the internet each week, including today's download from Mark Yusko, 144 pages of fantastic content. If you can, please help us defray our production costs by using the donate button on our homepage. Retweet our announcements. Tell your friends. Help promote the show by forwarding your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. Use the player embed to put a Macro Voices player on your favorite website. And most importantly, again, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Patrick, for our registered users, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Mark Yusko. In addition to that, like you referenced to, we have all of the reports provided by Mark Yusko that you and him referenced during the interview. We'll also find the links to Pete Wargent's articles and graphs that we discussed about Australian real estate. There's also a great article from Victor Schwetz of Macquarie Capital on Japan having no illusions that rates will ever rise. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with that MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric directly on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.